Support for America Reimagined comes from the Raymond James office in Idaho Falls, located at 450 B Street, and the Idaho Falls law firm of Smith, Wolf, Anderson, and Wilkinson. This week on America Reimagined, Dr. David Adler welcomes Professor Robert Spitzer and continues in our exploration of the question, is the United States presidency too powerful?
Welcome to another edition of the Alturas Institute's America Reimagined, this weekly radio program where we gather national experts to join us for a conversation about what America might look like under different circumstances, policies, programs, and laws. Today, we're meeting with a very distinguished political scientist, our old friend, Professor Robert Spitzer, distinguished service professor from State University of New York at Cortland, a previous guest, and thanks to his generosity and your urgings to invite him back, we're delighted to have a half-hour conversation with Professor Spitzer about an area that he knows so well, and that is the American presidency. As we've said before, Professor Spitzer has been the recipient of some of the Political Science Association's most distinguished awards. He's a prolific author, writing not only on the presidency, but some half dozen books on gun control and gun rights, which have earned him many appearances on national talk shows and various radio programs. He's the author of numerous op-eds. Today, we want to focus on the American presidency. And so I say to Professor Spitzer, welcome and happy to have you with us here on President's Day.
Thank you, David. It's uniquely an honor, really, to speak with you on this particular day.
This has been quite a weekend. We celebrated Abraham Lincoln's birthday on Friday, the 12th. The Senate of the United States acquitted President Donald Trump in his second impeachment trial. And here we are today celebrating the presidency. I wonder, as we think about this constellation of presidential themes and honors and critiques, do Americans praise the presidency too much? Are we too quick to praise and too quick to condemn? Somewhere there has to be a balance struck. And in your various works, you've addressed some of these themes over the years. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think both of those things occur. There is a certain schizophrenia about the American presidency. There's no doubt that there's a general tendency to venerate presidents and venerate past presidents in earlier eras. When we get closer to our own era, the contemporary politics of the time, I think, prevents that sort of veneration. But over time, history tends to view the past with more rose-colored glasses. So that is very much a part of our past and how we think about the office of the presidency. By the same token, I think there is also a certain tendency to blame the president for anything and everything that goes awry in the country. And to be sure, presidents have deserved blame for, you know, a great many things in our past, for the inability to respond to crises or to engage in disastrous policy options that result in disastrous outcomes. So it's not as though presidents don't deserve much criticism as well, and they have received that as well. And I guess it's important to remember that both of these things are going on. But what I would add is that it's important to remember that these are human beings, that they're operating in the context of their times, that we do tend to view the past with rose-colored glasses. And that's where I think some of the retrospective look at past presidents that's more sober and more analytical is very important. So, you know, it's important to remind ourselves what a decisive and important leader George Washington was, for example, commander-in-chief, the first president, the man who voluntarily decided not to seek more than two terms as president. A simple fact that was shocking at the time, because the assumption was who would willingly give up power when certainly Washington could have been elected to a third term, but he willingly set it aside. It was the right thing to do morally. It set a precedent that power alternation should be a part of the system. But Washington also was a slave owner, had hundreds of slaves that he maintained. He benefited from being a member of the aristocracy. He was a very arrogant and standoffish fellow. He was very difficult to deal with. He didn't really have close friends to speak of. So in terms of his personality makeup, you'd kind of say, well, this isn't the guy that you'd really want to kind of hang out with. But of course, we elect presidents to do a job. And on the whole, I think Washington deserves credit for everything that he did. But we have to remember that it's a more complicated picture, as is true in varying degrees of all of our presidents from the past up to the present.
You know, you make so many fascinating points. And if we stick with Washington for just a second, and of course, Americans, as you point out, venerate George Washington. Of course, the origins of President's Day really had its basis in a national holiday honoring George Washington, reflecting your point about how Americans revere George Washington. But I think you're right to point out that he was a human being, much going for him, a great character, but character flaws as well. And I'm wondering, as we examine presidents across history, it becomes more difficult for Americans to take a more or less distant or objective look at presidents at any particular time. And in superheated times, such as these past 4 years, I'm thinking that Americans may need to take better stock of the way in which presidents have behaved, how they've wielded their powers, whether they've been creative. And doesn't it raise again, Professor Spitzer, the question of what we want out of the American presidency? In the end, isn't that what's really at stake?
It certainly is. And the American people expect a great deal of their presidents. I mean, there is always something, a phenomenon well known to political scientists, that there is an inherent expectations gap, as it were, that affects every president. That is, every president comes into office making promises, winning an election, and the country expects a lot from presidents. And of course, they're not able to carry out every policy that they say they want to enact or achieve. Just because of the nature of the political system, it's a three-branch system, separated powers, checks and balances, of course. And so as a presidential administration proceeds, people's expectations are not fulfilled, at least, certainly not entirely. And as a consequence, president's popularity tends to decline over time. And by the time a president leaves office, generally speaking, their popularity is lower, and there is more disenchantment, no matter who the president is. And the degree of decline could be very dramatic, as it was for President Nixon, for example, who was elected in 1972 by over 60% of the vote. And two short years later, he's out of office. He's gone in disgrace. And of course, the public is not standing behind him then. George W. Bush suffered something fairly similar, where, especially after 9/11, he noted the highest popularity rating ever recorded for any president in history, reaching 90%. By the time he left office in 2008, his popularity was hovered around the upper 20s to 30%. And, the 8 years had worn on him. He had some pretty disastrous policy enactments that hurt his presidency, that hurt the country. So that expectations problem haunts every president. And it is partly a function of the fact that the people are attracted to heroic leaders. And they like the idea and pin hopes on the idea that a strong leader can turn things around, can improve things, can make the country better. And it's always a more complicated picture. A colleague of ours, who of course you know well, Lewis Fisher, has written very importantly on the important and underappreciated role Congress has played in advancing the major goals, policy goals in any given era. In fact, there is a new book out by, not by Lewis Fisher, by a different writer, about the Civil War era, which talks about the decisive role played by Congress during the Lincoln years, during the Civil War, that tumultuous time, that Congress really was critically important to winning the Civil War, to enacting post-Civil War policies and many other things that Lincoln often gets credit for. So the picture is more complex. The other branches of the government play a more important role than is generally given their due, but we do like executives. The country tends to be drawn to them, and presidents who, you know, talk down their office, who say they don't have the power, who don't try to do very much if that's their goal, are presidents who probably are not going to become president, because you don't get to be president, especially in these days, by talking about what you cannot do. And if you do become president, it's going to simply dog your tracks if you're making the argument that presidents shouldn't be involved in things, shouldn't get things done, and shouldn't exercise so much power. So it's kind of a trap that the country has, I think, always faced to some degree.
You know, when you talk about the fact that the public tends to foist all of its expectations on the president rather than turning to Congress, doesn't that create something of a danger for our Republican system, in which the presidency under the Constitution has limited powers? Because after all, how, if the president does not have constitutional power to address and resolve all the claims brought by the American people, does that encourage presidents to essentially usurp power, aggrandize authority, cross their constitutional lines in order to meet those expectations?
That's exactly what it does. And when I teach the presidency in my Introduction to American Government course, I begin with the big message about the modern American presidency, which is that it is characterized by the rise of presidential power progressively, not in a straight line, but that's the historical trend. Now, that doesn't mean that presidents can just get whatever they want to do done because of checks, because of limits on those powers, and because we're still a constitutional system. We are not a system that's an autocracy that has one person rule sole and alone. And Americans would surely reject such a system because it would be fundamentally undemocratic. But it is that tendency of presidents to want to get things done, and the country pushing presidents in that direction, to cause them to want to grab for more power. And that's where the checks and balances system and the role of the other branches of government and the other formal and informal institutions of American life must come into play to check that power and to try and remember that there are many different ways to achieve policy goals in the United States aside and apart from the president simply doing things.
And have you thought about the possibility that American citizens, when they have complaints and needs, would tend to turn more to Congress? This is the imaginative realm, I suppose, to seek solutions rather than to the president. Would that not help to redress this imbalance of power between the president and Congress that you've written about so eloquently over many years?
Well, it would if the American people could view Congress more in the way they view the presidency. But of course, the picture is inherently complicated because Congress is a legislative body made up of 535 individuals. All of them represent a small piece of the country, whether it's a congressional district or a state, and they're beholden to their constituents. So this is part of the fundamental difficulty with Congress more effectively sharing power with the presidency, which is that individual members of Congress are concerned with the people who elect them, and that represents a tiny fraction of the country, and what may be in the best interest, or their view, the best interest of the people from their home states and districts, may not necessarily be in the best interest of the country as a whole. And the founders struggled with this very idea and talked about it a great deal. And you had this debate about presidential power versus congressional power, and about the method of electing members of Congress and its relationship with the executive, precisely because they wanted Congress. And it will seem strange to your viewers and listeners to hear me say this, but the founders, in fact, wanted and constructed a system of legislative supremacy. We often think of the three-branch system as co-equal branches, and it's useful to frame things in that way. But if you look at what the founders actually did and where they put the power, the chief powers of governance go to Congress. And in fact, the two most important powers of any government, power over the use of force, military power, the police power, and spending power, the power over money, those powers squarely belong to Congress. The president has a role in that, to be sure, but Congress has those powers and has final say, if you think about veto override and the legislative process. That's what they anticipated. And so we've seen a fundamental realignment in the institutional relationships where today, I don't think anybody would think of Congress as the most important branch of government or the most powerful branch. Most people would probably say the presidency if forced to choose. But it's an indication of the thinking of the founders because they were afraid of an executive that could run amok. They didn't want another George III, hereditary powerful monarch. They didn't want a military dictatorship either. So they did their best in the summer of 1787 to try and strike a balance among these things. But in our modern context, does Congress need to play that stronger role? Absolutely it does. And one would hope that constituents would remind their representatives that they represent their states and districts, but they also legislate for the country as a whole.
That's a very nice review of constitutional principles. Your students are lucky to hear that lecture. When you talk about those principles and those fundamentals of our system, it makes me think that a number of our problems in this nation stem from the fact that American citizens don't have an adequate understanding about how the Constitution works, how the system works. You know that from your years in the classroom. But without a better understanding and people increasingly turning to the president, imposing expectations and ignoring Congress to the point where the reputation of Congress falls ever lower, down to 10% or so in some polls. What does that bode for the future? We've just seen the end of a president, Donald Trump, who at various points asserted, quote, unlimited powers and absolute powers under Article 2 of the Constitution, something none of his predecessors had ever uttered. Where are we going in the future with respect to presidential power, and are you concerned?
Well, if you think about the modern historical trajectory, going back several decades up to the present, it does seem to indicate a progression toward ever more executive power, or at least claims of executive power. Partly the concern I share about that as a political scientist is that there has been some theorizing in recent years which would seem to dignify the most extreme possible interpretation of executive power. Obviously, there's been a 220-year debate about how much power the president really has or should have. In the 1790s, Alexander Hamilton and James Madison engaged in a sort of a published duel in what were called the Pacificus Helvidius debates, which played out essays that were published in newspapers in the 1790s about this very question. I mean, it was a question that was really sort of unresolved back then. So no surprise that there's no simple pat answer now, but for modern analysts, some law school people to argue that presidents really have this extremely inflated view of presidential power. It's called the unitary theory of executive power. And frankly, that to me is disturbing, first because to my reckoning, it bears no relationship to even the Hamilton-Madison debates from 1790s. It goes well beyond that. Secondly, it pretends to offer itself as an originalist view or an originalist reinterpretation. And I do not believe there's anything originalist about that theory. What it's trying to do is to provide a theoretical justification for very extreme power grabs by the president. And, I think you can make a good argument that presidents need to be stronger in modern times than they were, let's say, in the 19th century. I mean, I would make that concession. Not everybody would by any means, perhaps not even you, Professor Adler. But I could make that argument. But that argument doesn't mean that presidents have or should have absolute power. And many of the power claims that President Trump made, I think, were simply not defensible by any sane reading of our constitutional system. Presidents are not autocrats. That's not what the system designed. And the outcome of that would not be one that anybody would want if any person among believers care about democratic principles.
You know, when we talk about the scope of presidential power, which you discussed so well, are you concerned about the outcome of the Senate impeachment trial? Are you concerned about its impact on the United States, on the future of the presidency, on the GOP, on American politics? I mean, this is a multiple choice quiz. Pick the topic that you are most concerned about. What are some of your concerns?
Well, I certainly have had concerns about the impeachment process. Naturally, it split the position of members of Congress on the impeachment question. The second one that President Trump faced split largely along party lines. That's not really a surprise. We are a party-based system. But if you look at the facts of the case, I don't think it can be dismissed as mere partisanship. And frankly, I don't think the Democrats had any appetite or desire to bring a second set of articles of impeachment. But because we have film footage, because the things that President Trump said and did, not just in his January 6th public speech in Washington, D.C., which was the predicate to the thousands of people marching on Capitol Hill and trying to trash the building and track down and capture, or perhaps kill members of Congress, because that's where we were inches from that outcome. But things that he had said going back to this past summertime, all of which provided fuel for this belief among supporters who, you know, want to believe him and who accepted the things that he said at face value, that it was a stolen election and rigged, and that there were millions of votes that were, you know, changed, or you know, that the election somehow should have gone to him, and of course it did not. And ironically, it actually turned, with all of the confusion and dislocation of this time that we're in, the election last fall was remarkably well run. And the results were multiply verified. And what Trump did, as you know, carefully scrupulously recorded on tape, was so beyond the pale. I mean, I can think of no president in our history who did anything even approaching this kind of thing. And I think Congress had to act, not because they necessarily thought they would get the two-thirds vote, but to make the case clear to the country and to say, as a matter of principle, that we cannot let this go by. This is making insurrection on our governing system, which is the antithesis of what our system is about. And I think Congress had to act on that basis.
In our last few minutes together, as you think about the nation going forward and dealing with great partisan divide, it seems to me that the leaders of the GOP are acutely aware of the fragile nature of the party's future, as witnessed in the speech by Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell in the aftermath of the vote to acquit, when he seemed to want to have it both ways. He said, on the one hand, Donald Trump was absolutely responsible for the insurrection, but he voted against conviction. He voted to acquit because he thought the Constitution didn't permit the Senate to try a former president. Is that a Senate leader who is doing his best to tape together the two wings of his party? And how successful might that be?
Well, it obviously was a political decision simply because his speech didn't conform with the vote that he cast. And the justification for it was one that I think is abundant writing and analysis has indicated really is a paper-thin justification. It's one that really doesn't sustain itself. The Senate clearly had every right to proceed with the impeachment trial and see it to its conclusion. I just don't think there's any doubt about that. And I think McConnell's words made clear enough that he believes in his heart that what Trump did was beyond the pale, and that he's hoping to reformulate his political party in the months and years ahead. I mean, Trump has run for re-election and has lost. He still has a strong following, of course, in the country, but there are many other Republicans interested in running for the presidency. I think we will see in the next few years, Trump's grasp on the Republicans begin to weaken. He will certainly have a strong following, that there's no doubt. But I just think his moment is now passing him by. And frankly, I don't think he has the stomach for a full-blown, full-out race to recapture the presidency in 2024. And the Republican Party is certainly in an existential crisis moment here, because most Republicans, not only in the country, but in Congress and government, did not approve of what Trump did, did not agree with it, and in private conversations would say as much, but for their own political reasons, most of them felt they could not vote that way, and so they voted to acquit Trump instead. I mean, I understand that as a political scientist, but I think they're trying to look ahead and hoping they can put this bad moment behind them to rebuild their political party.
In our last minute, I can't let you go on this President's Day without asking, who is your favorite president, and why is that person your favorite president?
Well, people ask that question fairly often, as you know. I know you've gotten it over the years. There are a lot of presidents I admire. Lincoln would be an obvious answer, but I will say in reading and in my study over the years, I would put George Washington at the top of the list. And the reason why is partly the reason why I admired Lincoln. It's because they overcame so much to do the right thing, despite the fact that their own personality was working against them, despite the fact that they struggled with demons every day. And it's the person who struggles yet manages to do the right thing, I think, that deserves even more admiration than the person who has the wind behind his back or her back. I would put them very close together, but I would say George Washington.
Certainly a very defensible choice, and a topic for another occasion. Professor Spitzer, thank you so very much for spending time with us today, for taking time out of your busy schedule. And I hope our listeners will pick up more and more of your books. We look forward to having your return in the weeks and months ahead. And we certainly will want to ask you a number of questions about gun rights in America. Thanks very much, Bob. Ladies and gentlemen, you've just heard another edition of America Reimagined with Professor Robert Spitzer. As we wind down today, I invite you to listen and enjoy a beautiful rendition of America the Beautiful by our friend and brilliant musician, Steve Eaton. And the lyrics are performed by State Senator Cherie Buckner-Webb and the young voice of Charlotte Laval. Stay well, long live the Republic.
Oh, beautiful, for spacious skies, for amber waves of grain, for purple mountains.
Audio and guest information for all episodes of America Reimagined can be found at kisu.org. Production assistance is provided by Taylor Nadal and Mandy Gardner. For more information about the Alturas Institute, visit alturasinstitute.com. Our rendition of America the Beautiful is a new arrangement created by the talented musician Steve Eaton and sung by Idaho State Senator Sherry Buckner Webb and 8-year-old Charlotte Laval.
From sea.